There's a lot of material in 2 Chronicles chapter 36 because we've been looking through the different Old Testament eras. And we've got the Old Testament era of the kings, and that's coming to an end here. And so we have in 2 Chronicles 36 the names of Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim, Zedekiah and Jehoiachin, the last four kings in the kingdom of Judah. Then they're carried away into Babylon, and we read about that, the captivity. That's here as well. That's a going away into exile. So that's the exile era. And then before the end of the chapter, verses 20 through to 23, we have the return era. And that, of course, was kick-started by Cyrus, the king of Persia, who by this time had taken over the whole kingdom of Babylon. So as I've said, 2 Chronicles chapter 36, it's sweeping us through parts of three eras here in a very short space of time. But tonight we're moving on to an era called the Silence Era. And what we're talking about is the period between the end of 2 Chronicles chapter 36 and Matthew chapter 1. Or put another way, the period between Malachi and Matthew. The end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New. We have 400 years where there are no prophets that are writing books that are contained in our scriptures. A lion that was caught up with the grand thought of his mastery of the jungle decided to make sure that all of the other animals about him knew that he was the king of the jungle. He was so confident that he went past all of the smaller animals and he goes straight up to the bear. "Who's the king of the jungle?" the lion demanded of the bear. The bear replied, "Why, you are, of course." And the lion stood and he gave a mighty roar of approval. But then next he went to the tiger. "Who's the king of the jungle?" he roared to the tiger. And the tiger quickly responded, "Well, everybody knows that you are, O mighty lion." And by this stage the lion is really popping up with pride. Next on the list of the animals that'll hear the question from the lion was the elephant. So the lion faces the elephant and he levels the same old question, "Who's the king of the jungle?" he challenged. The elephant grabbed the lion with his trunk, whirled him around in the air 5 or 6 times, slammed him against a tree, then he pounded him on the ground several times, sat on him once, dipped him in the lake, and then dumped him out on the shore. The lion battered and blew, struggled to his feet, peered at the elephant through his one good eye, and he said, "Look, just because you don't know the answer is no reason to get mean about it." The religious leaders of the silence era were very much like that lion. They pretended that they had power. They puffed out themselves. They became rather self-absorbed. Now it's been said, it's a common phrase, that some people drink at the fountain of knowledge while others only gargle. And those who were saying, "Oh, we are drinking at the fountain of knowledge. We're the people who know everything." Well, that's pretty much the way the religious leaders in the silence era was. But all of this pride caused a pattern of religious hypocrisy. That pattern led to self-destruction. And it made the period, the silence era, it made it one of the most disappointing in the entire history of the nation of the Jews. And so we've come to segment number 9 in the arc of Bible history tonight, the silence era, and we've explained that as the period between the Old and New Testaments. So where 2 Chronicles chapter 36 ends, and then again where Matthew takes up the storyline again, we have this 400 year period of silence. We have, as usual in the notes, the title, review. Fill in the blanks to bring the chart up to date with this era. So we've come from the creation era through the patriarch, Exodus, conquest, Judges, kingdom era. We were into the exile era, the return era. And now tonight in this study we have the silence era. If we're going to summarize what the silence era was all about, we have the storyline summary in the middle of page 2 on those notes. The summary is, Pharisees and others entomb the Israelites in legalism for the next 400 years. In other words, those old Pharisees that we read about in the New Testament, they come along and they put Israel in a straitjacket. And they tell them, here are the rules, here are the laws. Oh, you don't have enough laws, here's a few more. You still don't have enough, here's even more laws. And so we say here, the Pharisees and others entomb the Israelites in legalism for the next 400 years. There are four main subjects in the silence era, and so we come therefore to the storyline expansion. The storyline expansion, the four parts of that are the changing of the guard, the political sects, the religious sects, and then the messianic hope, that is, Jesus is coming and we are looking forward to it, the messianic hope. So, four main sections we have, four main subjects. Number one, the changing of the guard we look at now, and that's the march of the nations. At the close of the Old Testament, Jerusalem, as we saw from the end of 2 Chronicles chapter 36, is ruled over by Persia, and the king Cyrus is on the Persian throne at this time. Now he has allowed Ezra, he has allowed Nehemiah as well, to go back to the land of Judah to set up Jerusalem, rebuild its walls and its temple, and therefore they put real form and a pattern into the worship and into the politics of Jerusalem once more. So after 70 years of exile, the people have come home, and they are beginning to get back on their feet. Now, it's important to realize that when they did come home, the Jewish people are no longer a nation that have clear-cut geographical boundaries. It's not as if there's a border here and there are all Jews within the border, no Jews outside of the border. It was not as clear-cut as that. Many exiles did return from Babylon, but many more remained there in Babylon. They had thoroughly adapted to the way of life in that land of Babylon. By the close then of the Old Testament period, around 400 BC, you had a Jewish community not just in Jerusalem and in Judah, but you had a Jewish community now in Babylon. You had a Jewish community right through the Persian Empire, from Egypt into what is now eastern Iran. So the Jews had begun to filter out. That's why I say you just couldn't draw a line and say this is the boundary of the one country they were living in. They had spread. On the page 4 we read about the coming of the Greeks. Judah remained part of the Persian Empire until 333 BC. At that time, the Persian Empire fell, and it was conquered by Alexander of Macedon, otherwise known and famously referred to as Alexander the Great. Alexander began a policy of Hellenization. He came in and he brought his own culture, the Greek culture. And he began to impose that throughout all of the peoples that he conquered. So, right across the massive empire that Alexander the Great eventually built up, he was Hellenizing it. He was putting the Greek culture like a blanket all over it. When Alexander died in 323 BC, that empire of his was divided among his generals, and they continued this process of Hellenization. Palestine initially belonged to Ptolemy, whose dynasty ruled over Egypt, but then it was taken from the Ptolemies by the dynasty of Seleucus, who ruled Syria and Mesopotamia. That's all about Alexander the Great. He was the son of Philip of Macedon, and he marched down from Macedonia, and he attacked Darius, who was the king of Persia and Media at this time. Darius was defeated by Alexander, and therefore his throne was taken by Alexander. Alexander the Great goes on, he fights many battles, he captures fortified cities, and we read about that in a book, a history book of the Jews, the 1 Maccabees chapter 1 and the verse 1.
And again, with this victory of Alexander the Great over Darius III, the king of Persia, the Macedonians assumed the mantle of the strongest nation of the world. Strongest used to be the Babylonians. Then it was the Persians. Now it is the Greeks under Alexander the Great. Alexander took a target here and he thought, right, we want to conquer Egypt. And so he's moving from Macedonia down through Palestine, and he wants eventually to get down into the country of Egypt, conquering as he goes. Gets a force of 32,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and he marches south. He's 24 years of age at this time, a pretty young guy to be fronting up such a large and a formidable force. Offshore, he has 160 ships sailing down with supplies and with men. Now, on the way down from Macedonia down to Egypt, he is held up twice on the coast of Serbia and Palestine. First of all, he's held up at Tyre. Tyre at the time was a Phoenician city. It was heavily fortified. If you'd have been around at the time, you'd have seen stout and high walls. You'd have known the tower would have been built on a small island just off the coastline, and so it was very well guarded indeed. But Alexander the Great was a military supremo of considerable note. He pulled off a masterstroke here of military ingenuity. He built what they called a mole, 2,000 feet long. In sea, like a big piece of land that stretched right out to this island city of Tyre. Of course, he wasn't able to do it without opposition, so what he did was, he had a lot of mobile protective shields. Men carrying shields that went along and protected the workers who were building this mole, and they called those who were carrying the shields tortoises. And eventually, despite the hail of missiles that came tumbling down upon them, they got the causeway built from the land, the Phoenician coast, right out to the offshore city of Tyre. Now, at the same time that the people were out there building the causeway to stretch to Tyre, his engineers were onshore, and they were building monsters called helipolites. These were really towers, very strongly protected, many stories high. And these towers would have been holding bowmen and light artillery. They had a drawbridge in the front of the towers, and that allowed a surprise attack to be made when you would wheel the towers out across the causeway right up to the enemy's walls. These happened to be the highest siege towers that were ever used in the history of warfare. Each of them had 20 stories, and the highest platform towered a height of over 160 feet far above the highest city walls. Now, it took a while to do. So after 7 months of diligent preparation, these monster towers, bristling with their weapons, slowly and clumsily rolled along the causeway towards Tyre. And whenever they started to come, well, there was going to be no hope for Tyre. Just as the Bible had prophesied, this is how it would turn out. In Zechariah chapter 9, the verses 3 and 4, the Bible says, "And Tyrus did build herself a stronghold." So she did. "And heaped up silver as the dust, and fine gold as the mire of the streets. But behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he shall smite her power in the sea, and she shall be devoured with fire." And so it happened under Alexander the Great. Zechariah 9, verse 5 informs us that Gaza also shall see it and be very sorrowful. And that reference in Zechariah 9, verse 5, also ties into the same year in the life of Alexander the Great. I said that Alexander's trying to make it from Macedonia down to Egypt. He gets held up twice. One occasion is Tyre. The other occasion is that place just referred to in the other part of the prophecy in Zechariah 9 and 5. It's the city of Gaza. The old Philistine town that is so much in the news still today as a scene of conflict and as a place where Israel is hated. Well, it was the second place where this Macedonian king, Alexander the Great, was brought to a halt. The siege didn't last 7 months there, it was only 2 months.
And then, when they had conquered Gazum, the road to the Nile and into Egypt lay wide open.
Seems that after conquering Gazum, Alexander hurried on by the quickest road down to Egypt. He sent across a number of forces to conquer the territory. They were under the general Parmenium, and he had no difficulty in subduing the city round about. On the way to Egypt, there was only Samarium, that was the seat of the governor of the province, that had to be forcibly brought into line. And as its punishment, a colony of Macedonians were settled in Samaria. Judah submitted to the forces of Alexander the Great without a struggle. Now, by all accounts, this Greek conqueror pretty much tolerated the way of life that Judah was enjoying at this period of time. Their life was left unmolested. They were allowed to function still as a religious community. Alexander didn't really want to interfere with them. And archaeology shows that this is what happens. There are no traces in Judah of either a Greek conquest or a Greek occupation in Judah at this particular time, so we can assume that Alexander just sailed basically straight through. And there was no battle fought here. Egypt welcomed Alexander with open arms. They looked upon him as a bit of a liberator, and he came storming in the winter of 332 to 331 BC. The city of Alexandria was founded on the western tip of the Nile Delta. It was destined to be a large city, a very influential and important city in the years to come. It quickly blossomed into a centre of intellectual life that all of the greatest minds of the Greek and Oriental world, they flocked to Alexandria. And so we hear about the Greek philosophers. Well, if you want to find one, shake hands with one, you'd have gone in this day to Alexandria. That's where they all hung out. At its foundation, Alexander issued instructions that were to be of great significance in future days. He guaranteed that the Jews, who were descendants of the refugees in the Babylonian era, would have rights that would be protected by him. And because he protected the Jews, we find that Alexandria became one of the great reservoirs of Jewish life and Jewish culture. Now, this name of the city, Alexandria, doesn't appear in the Bible until we get as far as the book of Acts. There we read in Acts 18, verse 24, about a Jew named Apollos, who was a native of Alexandria, who came to Ephesus, and, true to form with Alexandria, Apollos was a learned man. He had a thorough knowledge of the Scriptures. Alexander, though he was a mighty conqueror, did not live really that long at all. And on the way to one of the greatest, most successful military expeditions in all of history, Alexander marched once again through Palestine. Every country in the ancient East fell before his forces. He pressed on as far as the Indus River, almost to the foot of the Himalayas. But on the way back, Alexander was attacked by a fever, and he died in Babylon at the young age of 33 on the 13th of June, 323 B.C. What's going to happen now that Alexander is dead? Basically, the Greek Empire was divided into three kingdoms. He knew he was going to die, and when he knew that, Alexander called together his generals and divided up the empire, and he gave a part to each of those three generals. And when he died, the generals took control. And each had himself crowned king in that territory. Now the descendants of these kings rule for many generations. And they brought not a great deal of good, but of misery upon the world. And we read about that in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 7 to 9. You see, Alexander's three generals that succeeded him had no scruples about getting rid of Alexander's whole family. They murdered them, just to make sure there was no possibility of one of Alexander's sons or relatives rising up and taking over the entire empire. And then they divided that empire into not just areas, but actual kingdoms. The kingdom of Macedonia. In northern Greece, it was ruled over by Antigonus, and by the dynasty founded by him. So that's part one of the Greek Empire. Then the second part was the kingdom of the Seleucids, extended from Thrace through Asia Minor and Syrium, right as far as the borders of Indium. One of the chief towns here was Antioch, on the lower reaches of the Orontes in the north of Syrium, and they had Seleucia on the river Tigris. These would have been capitals, main cities, of the second and by far the largest of the states that succeeded the reign of Alexander. The third part of the kingdom was a Ptolemaic kingdom on the Nile with Alexandria as its capital, ruled over by a dynasty, and the last representative of the dynasty, we'll have all heard about her, was Cleopatra. Now during this kingdom, the Greek kingdom, we have great advancements in the Greek language and also the Greek culture. We've already said that the city of Alexandria became a major force. And under a couple of far-sighted rulers, Ptolemy I and his son Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, they really made sure that this center, Alexandria, became a very important city, a real center of learning and culture, and its fame extended far beyond the borders of their own kingdom. A lot of people came into it from Judah and from many other parts of the globe. It seemed to be a magnet, drawing all of the main minds to the beauty of the Greek language and to the crucible here of learning and knowledge and culture that was Alexandria. The Greek language became the international language of learning and of business and commerce. It became the language for tens of thousands of Israelites who by now knew no other home. We write here about the Septuagint. We are familiar with the King James Authorized Version, 1611. We are familiar with a whole squad of other versions since 1881, the Revised Version, and then many others have followed since then, the 1970s, the NIV, and so on. Today's NIV is out, and many others. We have a lot of queries and problems, and some big problems with those. But here is a version of the Bible, a way back in the Greek civilization, called the Septuagint. It has something to do with 70, and we'll explain that briefly in a moment or two. But we've talked about the Israelites moving down, at least some of them, people from Israel and Judah, down into Alexandria in Egypt, where Alexander had given a decree that they would be protected and their rights would be looked after, and down they went. But by the time they were having children here, then this rising generation did not know Hebrew as their mother tongue. They could no longer follow the sacred text, the Old Testament written in Hebrew, when they went to the services in the synagogue. And so it came about that these Jews in Egypt decided, we want a Bible here that we can read in our own language, which now is the Greek language. And about 250 BC, the Torah, the Jewish Old Testament, was translated into Greek. And that became really important for Western civilization. Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, sent envoys up to the high priest, looking for the copy of the five books of Moses, that Torah. He had a very extensive library, 995 books, but Ptolemy II, when he looked around it, didn't have the books of Moses, and so he was looking for a copy of these, and at the same time, he asked for men who could be sent down to translate these books of Moses into the Greek language that they were speaking and reading. The high priest granted his request, and he sent as well as the copy of the Torah, 72 learned men who were scribes. They were really happy to find them here in Alexandria, and they got about the task of translating the Old Testament into the Greek language. When they finished it, they called it the Septuagint, meaning 70. And so what had only been known in the sanctuary in the old Hebrew tongue, only to one nation, is now from Alexandria made available and made intelligible for people of other tongues and other nations. This is a big event in the history of the Bible. But then the Seleucids, that's in the second part of the Greek Empire, when it's been carved up into three sections here, the Seleucids, they wanted to expand southwards. And they forced their way southwards. They took on Ptolemy V at the sources of the Jordan, and they had Antiochus III, called Antiochus the Great, who took over Palestine in the year 195 BC, and so Judah has got new rulers yet again. So we're changing hands a lot here. Babylon had taken them over. Then the Persians had come in and taken over Babylon, and so Israel was under new leadership, new management. Then Alexander the Great had come, and they were under the Greek Empire. And now that he had died and his former empire was carved up into three, it's still the Greek Empire as such, but just subdivided now. Well, this second part of it has now taken over the nation of Judah. We have at the bottom of page 9 a reference to Antiochus Epiphanes. When Antiochus Epiphanes became king of Syria in the year 137 BC, we can check it out in 1 Maccabees 1 and 10, we had Jason becoming a high priest in Jerusalem by rather corrupt means. What Antiochus did was come in, push his authority around in Jerusalem. Tell them, you need to change now to the Greek way of life. You can't be Jews in the way that you've been over all of these years. We want you to have a new culture here. And so he built a stadium near the Temple Mount, led the Jewish people, the finest of the young men of them, to adopt the Greek custom of getting into the athletic events, later becoming the Olympic Games. And we have a craze here for the Greek way of life and for foreign customs that are breaking out here in Judah. And it becomes such a craze that even the priests lose interest in their sacred duties, lose interest in turning up at the temple, lose interest in offering the sacrifices. And as soon as the signal was given, they would rush down through the streets of Jerusalem and take part in the games that were forbidden under the Jewish law. 2 Maccabees 4, verses 7 to 14. Now, why was there such excitement here about these gymnastics and sports, later to become, as we say, the Olympics, the Greek games? Well, they're pretty much similar to the Olympics today, the kind of sports that they have today, pretty much similar to what they had then. The dress was the main difference. They didn't have dress. Those Greek games would have been played back then completely naked. Now, to do this, just a few steps from the Holy of Holies, to do this in full viewing of the temple, was an outrageous insult against the Jews and against their law. Nakedness had been a terrible temptation, an awful sin that Israel had fallen into in the days of Balaam, the son of Beor, who tempted them until Israel had collapsed through immorality. And now the sin of immorality, nakedness, became Judah's great temptation again. Now, added to the problem of the nakedness in these Greek games, there was a much deeper significance to the games than what athletics and sport would have in our modern era. Back then, the games were really religious exercises dedicated to the foreign Greek gods Zeus and Apollo. And the reaction, therefore, of Orthodox Judaism to this threat to their religion was going to be uncompromising, and so it turned out. And we can see that in the second section here that we're coming to, Maccabees and the Zealots. But before we get to the Maccabees and we get to the Zealots, it sprang up in the land at this time. Another power comes in, another empire, and it's the Roman period.
And you'll remember, of course, the image of Nebuchadnezzar back in Daniel chapter 2. And the different parts of this image that he saw in the dream. And how it began with the Babylonian Empire, Nebuchadnezzar's own force. And then it was taken over by the Medes and the Persians. Then it was taken over by the Greeks. And then, of course, the fourth main power to come in was the Romans. And this is the path that's been followed here, just as the Bible said. And so at the bottom of page 10, we're into the Roman period, 63 BC through to AD 324. As that middle section of the former empire that belonged to Alexander began to crumble, the Seleucid Empire, as it disintegrated, the Roman general Pompey invaded Syria to bring stability to the region. He also stepped into the Judean affairs to end a civil war that had broken out between rival factions of the Hasmonean House. And after a 3-month siege, Roman legions marched into Jerusalem in 63 BC. Judah now becomes a Roman province. And it's still like this, as the dates will show us clearly, 63 BC through to AD 324. It is still a Roman province when Jesus the Messiah comes. And so he's tried before Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, because the Romans are now in charge. The political independence of Israel came to an abrupt end when the Romans came. Judah, that now became Judea, became tributary to Rome in 63 BC, and so we have Caesar ruling on the empire's throne. Pontius Pilate is representative on the ground in Judah, or now Judea, but we have a puppet king who's a Jew, who is reigning, and he is called Herod the Great. And he's just ruling by the sheer goodwill of the Roman authorities, and he is answerable in all that he does to the Roman authorities, this little puppet king called Herod. And so Jesus, when he's tried, is tried before both Herod the Jewish king, in name alone, and Pilate, the representative of the Roman Empire, where there was the real power, and so it had to be Pilate who held the real reins of power, who condemned Jesus to death. So that's how the four kingdoms here, one after another, they replaced each other. But then we come to section 2, the political sects, the Maccabeans and the Zealots. Some Jews in Jerusalem were strongly opposed to the changing, the Hellenization of their culture, and it was beginning to threaten the distinctiveness of Judaism. They were not having their rights anymore. They were not having free religious expression anymore. And so throughout the 400 silent years, they try to revolt against the foreign rule, and they make Jerusalem and the surrounding area of Judea an independent country. In 167 BC, the Seleucid king Antiochus the Fourth, he was getting worried about his southern realm, and he comes into Judah here, and he tries to eradicate Judaism from its homeland. But the Jews rise up in rebellion. Rise up in rebellion under the leadership of Judas Maccabeus. And in 164 BC, Antiochus revoked those anti-Jewish decrees that he was imposing upon the people. Now, this Hebrew freedom fighter, Judas Maccabeus, went on to fight for political as well as religious freedom. And he achieved this in 128 BC. We had an independent Judean kingdom then for the next 65 years. We talk here about the battle for religious liberty in the middle of page 11. King Antiochus the Fourth, called Epiphanes, he comes in and he plunders and desecrates the temple in Jerusalem in 168 BC. And a lot of people believe here, recorded in the 2 Maccabees 5 and 16, that he was the one who came and he set up the abomination of desolation that Daniel the prophet talked about. He put up the initial, at least, fulfillment
of that prophecy, set up the abomination of desolation here in Jerusalem. Plundering temples was Antiochus IV's speciality. Loved to do it. So Jerusalem is plundered and burned. But he doesn't get enough treasure out of the Jerusalem temple. And so he sends his chief tax collector, Apollonius, with an armed force to Jerusalem. This man, he plundered the city, he set it on fire, he tore down the buildings, he ripped down the walls. He and his army took the women and the children as prisoners. They seized the cattle as well. And all of this is documented in 1 Maccabees 1, 29-32, 2 Maccabees 5, verse 24, and right through that particular chapter. And he said, I'm going to crush, I'm going to destroy the faith of Israel. So their religion is now being attacked. Heathen worship is established in the temple. And we have the worship of the Olympian Zeus set up in the Jewish temple, the temple of Jehovah. Now for Jews, this is the last straw. They were tired of what King Antiochus IV was doing. But now to find that he sets up an image of the Olympian Zeus in their temple. Well, that's the last thing they are tolerated. They have now their sacrifices banned, their religious ceremonies outlawed, the Sabbath, circumcision. If you're celebrating the Jewish festivals, the penalty is death. The Old Testament Holy Scriptures were destroyed. And this really, under Epiphanes, was the first thoroughgoing, wide-reaching religious persecution in history. And so the Jews revolt. Many of them prefer to die rather than break the Holy Covenant. But it was an old man in his resolute faith that kindled the torch of revolt in the land, a man by the name of Mattathias. He had five sons, he was a priest. And they came in around him, they offered sacrifices and he burnt incense. And they abandoned the law of God in the place where he lived, a place called Modin. Small village, 20 miles from Jerusalem. Out in the western fringe of the highlands of Judah. And he decided that he would take the law into his own hands. And he went and he took the man who was offering the sacrifice. And he killed that man on the altar. And also killed the royal official who was forcing the people to sacrifice. And he tore down the altar. That act was the signal of open resistance against the rule of Epiphanes in the kingdom of Judah, and it started off the wars of the Maccabees. We detail those wars of the Maccabees on page 12. You read about them on page 13. There's some archaeological evidence for them as well that they found in Beth Zur. Find a lot of coins in 1931. And also they find a powerful fortress on the hill, and they can check out the stages of its construction as well there. The record ends, these wars of the Maccabees, with the murder of Simon, who was the brother of Judas Maccabeus. And at that time the spiritual and political leadership of Judas was transferred down through the line of these men that were fighting a guerrilla warfare against the forces of Epiphanes. And the leadership was transferred along with the office of high priest to Simon's son John. You can read about all of that detail in the box there. Bottom of page 13, running right down towards the bottom of page 14. But what was happening was that under the Maccabean persons, Judah was having success against the forces of Epiphanes. They were constantly fighting, always pushing the enemy back, extending their borders farther and further, until it came to when they were under the rule of Alexander Janaeus. Their territory was so enlarged here that they almost covered the area that was previously the territory of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. So they had really pushed the boundaries of their kingdom under these freedom fighters. And the map on page 15 shows that Maccabean kingdom at the time of Alexander Janaeus. And if you compare the names that are in there and the territory that's in, you've Galilee in within their borders, you've Idumea, you've got Moab, you've got Perea, you've got Judea. It's basically all in there. Almost the kingdom of David in the earlier Old Testament times. You see, the Seleucids in the middle of the country, they became less and less serious enemies. They lacked the strength to cope with these Maccabeans. And then Rome came, and they expanded their authority and territory beyond Greece into Asia Minor, and they were the ones that took on, finally, the Maccabeans. So we've covered two sections. We have two very brief ones to come in this silence era. So the first section was the changing of the guard, the march of the nations, the four main empires, then the political sects that rose up in revolt whenever the Jewish religion came under threat, the Maccabeans and the Zealots. Now we have the religious sects at this time, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. These were the two primary religious parties in Jerusalem at this time. Pharisees and Sadducees. Now, neither offered much guidance in true spirituality. They were caught up in following and promoting a religious legalism. Just adhere to this law, do that law, do the other law. Laws, laws, everywhere you looked. While they overrode those laws themselves. But the Pharisees were orthodox and they were conservative. And they were fostering separation between themselves and secular society. They were proud, looking down their noses at the people mixed up in the Hellenistic and the Greek culture and the Roman traditions all around them. The name Pharisees may mean the separated ones. But they most likely trace their origins to the 2nd century BC. They were mostly ordinary Jews, they were not priests, and they adhered closely to the Jewish law, and they were extending all the time the scope of those Jewish laws until the point that he made them impossible to fulfill. People just couldn't do what the Pharisees required of them. And so in, for example, Matthew 23, our Lord Jesus abrades and attacks those, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites!" And he said, "You put laws on people that you yourselves don't even observe." For example, work on the Sabbath day, according to the Pharisees, meant walking more than 3/5 of a mile, 1 kilometer from your own time. Work on the Sabbath meant carrying any kind of loot. Work on the Sabbath would also be constituted as lighting a fire that was within the home. These strict rulings were brought in by the Pharisees to build a fence around the law. And they thought that, well, if the people here are burdened with detailed rules, they'll be in less danger of actually breaking through so far as to disobey the real law of God. They were very distinctive in their dress. Two articles of dress became their trademarks. One of these was the phylactery, a little box that you would see on Orthodox Jews' heads, even to this very day. Box of metal or bands of parchment, and they'd have fastened it to the forehead by straps, or even to the hand they would have attached their phylactery. Inside the phylactery were passages of Scripture, referring to the Passover and the redemption of the firstborn from Egypt, Exodus 12 and Exodus 13, verses 9 and 16. And those phylacteries that were worn by the Pharisees, they were always broader on them. Bigger phylacteries they had than anybody else had. The other badge that stood out about their dress was they had large blue fringes put along the corners of their mantles. Numbers 15, 37, 38, Deuteronomy 22 and 12 talks about that mantle. But the Pharisees, they wore extremely long fringes, and Jesus denounces that as well in Matthew 23 and the verse 5. Now there were about 6,000 of these Pharisees. Many of them tried to be godly men. And as far as their knowledge was concerned, they were pretty godly men, but they despised everybody who didn't live up to their standard or try to keep their burdensome laws, and Jesus was always in conflict with them. And we give two men here, two famous Pharisees, the names of them, Nicodemus and Paul. who were converted on the Christ. But we have also how Jesus contended with them. A lot of reference there, like Matthew 12, verses 1 to 42, Matthew 22, verses 34 through to 23, 36, Mark 7, 1 to 23, Luke 18, 9 to 14, John 18 and 3, Acts 26, 6 to 10. There was a lot of controversy. Wherever the Pharisees were, there was always an argument. Now, the other religious sect at the time were more liberal. They were the Sadducees. They were the party of the big noises in Jerusalem, the aristocracy. They used their wealth, they used their influence, their power to keep the political waters calm. And while they were much smaller as a group than the Pharisees, they had much more clout and influence. The Sadducees were members of the families of priests. They supported the Hasmonean high priest kings and later the Roman rulers that took the priests after they had quelled the Hasmonean civil wars. Now, there's not a lot of reliable information about the Sadducees. Much of it comes from their enemies, their opponents. What we do know is that they did not accept the Pharisees' extensions of the law, as is clear in Matthew 16, 1 to 12, Mark 12, 18 to 27, Acts 4, 1 and 2, chapter 5, verses 17 to 19, and Acts 23, 6 to 10. The Sanhedrin was a ruling board made up of representatives out of the Pharisees and also out of the Sadducees, but the two groups had little in common. Apart from their desire for religious freedom, and later they had this in common, they both hated Jesus of Nazareth, the Messiah. Number four, very briefly, the Messianic hope, expectation of a Saviour. That one who had been prophesied for so long through the Old Testament, who would come and save the Jews. Some thought it would be spiritual salvation. Others were only looking for political salvation. Come and throw the Greeks out. Come and throw the Romans out. That's what we want a Messiah to do. Was as far as most people really wanted him to operate. But for both these reasons, political and religious, there was an expectation in the country. There was a hope in the country for the coming of the Messiah. And it was strong, this hope, for the 400 years of the silence period. People are preparing for, looking for, pleading for Messiah to come. And the events that occurred during the silence era seem really to put in a good foundation for Messiah to come. During the silent era, this part of the world took on a common language and a common culture that allowed the message of Messiah to spread easily. The Roman Empire, during the silence period, has brought military peace to the region. The police usually was up in arms and rebellious and fighting. Under the Romans, now knows peace. Also under the Romans, this area has an extensive system of roads building up and sea travel as well. And a common government is in place so that the people now can travel extensively without interference. Getting the picture? The stage is being set for Jesus. One language, the Greek language, common culture, peace in the region. Big network of roads, and the network of roads brought in by the Romans, sea travel available to many. A government that allows people to travel without interference, and so when Jesus comes, the message can go out quickly, readily, easily, and far. And then a third factor during the silent era, the Jews were suffering for this time. Religious persecution under the Seleucids. Epiphanies, political humiliation, they were suffering. And as they suffered, it made the hope within their hearts for the coming Messiah beat stronger. So these facts add up to make the coming of Jesus of Nazareth, the Messiah, an event that would captivate the Jewish world.